Hello, this is Jim Wallace, and you're listening to a special edition of The Soul of the Nation, a podcast about how our faith should shape our politics and not the other way around. Today I'm speaking with Billy Shore. Billy Shore is the founder and chairman of Share Our Strength and the architect of the No Kid Hungry campaign aimed at ending childhood hunger in America. Because of the coronavirus, schools have been closed nationwide, and so far, 22 million children in need have lost over 800 million school meals. 800 school meals that they depend upon. For many, it's the only healthy food they might get in a given day. No Kid Hungry has a plan to feed those kids, but they need your help. Visit NoKidHungry.org today and find out how you can help feed America's children during this crisis and in the months to come. That's NoKidHungry.org. And you can also hear the inspirational stories of people doing good work all over the country by listening to Billy's podcast, Add Passion and Stir. I love that. That's Add Passion and Stir. You can hear it on your favorite podcast app or go to addpassionandstir.com. Billy, welcome to this conversation. I always love talking to you, and boy, what a time that we should be talking, like right now.
Well, thanks. Thanks for taking the time, Jim, and I always learn from you, so let's dive in.
So, Billy, how's your spirit?
Well, that's the right question. You go right to the heart of the matter, Jim, as always. And I think, you know, my spirit, probably like everybody else's, has been on a bit of a roller coaster. In many cases, it's strengthened by seeing the incredible generosity of people that manifests itself in so many different kinds of acts, some financial, some just, you know, commitment on the front lines. But then I have nights where I, you know, watch the evening news and I wonder if I'm going to be able to fall asleep that night, just given how much concern there is for people we don't know and people we do. So I'd say it goes up and down, and my sense is that's been the case with a lot of folks. How about you? How's your spirit?
Yeah, that's always the first question that I need to ask of myself every day, not just the work and how we're doing and my long to-do list. I think that I've been shifting from this notion of social distancing. I've been saying for every day is can't lead to social isolation. That's for sure. But more and more, I'm not wanting even to say social distancing. I'm wanting to say physical distancing, because we just can't have the social isolation. And so how do we stand apart, but really live and act in solidarity? And that's, I think, the role of the faith community. So every day I'm with my two boys here and my wife, and I'm trying to figure out how can we get closer together, even while we're physically apart. And so I think that's sort of every day I'm looking at, like all of us, I have my little pad next to me of my personal prayer vigil pad, and people who are close, family and others who've got the virus, and I have my sister and her husband and three of their kids have it in Detroit, and so my text keeps pinging all day long. My family's pinging her. Right. So in the middle of my work, that's all. So we all have that in a way. We're working and we got this pinging from people close to us. So it's very personal, and yet it's so big. The numbers, like you, Billy, are staggering to me. The death tolls and all the rest. It's staggering. So how do we respond to something so big and staggering, but it's going to be very personal for everybody that we know?
And I'm assuming that you're also, just kind of given your role and responsibilities as a leader, are also trying to, in some ways, model this behavior you've just described for your larger team.
Yeah, and we're also convening now a weekly conference call for about 100 faith leaders who, when this began, I asked if people wanted to call, and they did, 2 days' notice, and now they want to do it every week. And so we're having how to take faith virtual, you might say. How do we do that? How do we figure out as church leaders and pastors and communicators how to stand apart? Well, I mean, our role is to get close to people, particularly vulnerable people like you and I. That's our everyday conversation in our heads. And we're going to have here is how do we not let vulnerable people be left out? And, you know, they say this virus doesn't discriminate. Well, medically, that's true. But for vulnerable people, it does, because the more vulnerable you are, less access to you and I are in safe houses this morning with our families, and we have, you know, food and income, and people don't have that. It, you know, they're going to contract the disease. So I'm trying to figure out, and my team at Sojourners is trying to figure out how do we be close to the vulnerable in a time when they're going to be marginalized. And that's what you do all the time. So I guess on that, remember you and I had a conversation when it was just starting and the schools were closing and we were worried about kids losing breakfast and lunch. And I remember on the phone we were saying, how can we mobilize churches and the whole nation? And we didn't expect the schools to come through, and all of a sudden they did. They're trying in all kinds of ways to feed kids. And so we're in the middle of those conversations too. I'm sure you're more in the middle of those conversations about how those kids don't get completely left behind. So what are the vulnerable? What's their a pre-existing condition? It's poverty and racism. Those are pre-existing conditions that make it help you get the disease.
Well, that's a really good way to put it. And, you know, I keep thinking and seeing more evidence of the idea that so much about this COVID crisis is similar to the work that we've been doing for a long time, and especially one aspect of it, I guess, which is that that at least in terms of feeding people during this crisis, that aspect of it in itself is at least a solvable problem. You know, the news has been dominated by stories of terrible shortages of, you know, masks and ventilators and hospital beds and all the rest. But we have no shortage of food. What we do have, and what we've always had, and this has really been the work of Share Our Strength and the No Kid Hungry campaign, at least for the last 10 years, is we have a lot of barriers, some political, some bureaucratic, some relating to indifference and neglect, but a lot of barriers between children and families and the healthy food that they need. And it's always been our job to, you know, knock down those barriers. Now we're doing it in different ways. We used to do it by figuring out what are the barriers to kids who are eligible for getting school meals, actually getting them. Sometimes it wasn't logistically convenient. Sometimes there was the stigma attached to it. Now there's a different set of barriers. And we're not just dealing with a percentage of kids who should have been getting school meals, but weren't. We're dealing with all kids who are getting school meals. So 50 million American public school students, a very high percentage of them, were getting free or reduced price meals and depending on them. And now the barriers are not in the school. They're by virtue of the fact that we've had to move the feeding programs to the school parking lot or to the YMCA to other places. But, you know, ultimately, one thing I guess that gives me some encouragement is, again, at least this narrow piece of the crisis is solvable, but it exists for the same reason you were just describing. And I love the way you use the term pre-existing conditions. So the pre-existing conditions of inequality and lack of opportunity and poverty and all of these things which are tied to each other are the reasons that we're seeing so many kids and families struggling. And hopefully, I think we're all wondering in what ways, when we get to the other side of this, are we different? Do we just go back to doing things the way we used to do them? If we're able to take faith virtual, as you just said, will that continue after this, or will we go back to kind of the conventional ways? Are we going to think about people and families who've been struggling to eat during this crisis and then just go back to the way it was before? I think that's a big question. And I think, I guess, one of our responsibilities or charges from a leadership point of view is to help people see how we can make some permanent changes. So the next time there's such a crisis, the vulnerable are not as vulnerable. We're more on an equal footing.
When you think about that, that's very, very close to my heart too. In fact, there's a text I've been thinking about, Ephesians 5:16. It says, redeem the time, for the days are evil. Redeem the time, the days are evil. So these are evil days in many ways. And I think we were living in some evil days before this virus hit, but it's now our time is different. It's you and I we're sheltering and with our families, and so many people are doing that or they're on the front lines. Friends of mine, close people are on the front lines. A lot of low-income people who aren't even residents and doctors, they're in the front lines too. But how do we take this moment? This virus is revealing so much of what was true before. How so many people, you said, were hungry before in this country, the richest country in the world. And so it's revealing what is wrong that we've either not recognized or we've accepted it. And how can we redeem this time to look at not just immediate response to people, which you're doing every day to feed people, but also how this will change us, how we act, how we lead, what we do now will change us going forward. History is being changed by this. So how will those changes result in our being different going forward? And food, you know better than I, food is, it reveals so much, you know, why people are hungry. There is enough food. There is enough. Why are we people hungry? And what are you seeing for kids, especially what you see? How when you say things would change permanently in terms of food, what would that mean, do you think?
Well, I wish I knew. I hope it means that there's the consciousness that's been elevated now remains there. So we've been doing this work for a long time, and we've always had a good base of support. But suddenly we've heard from people. I'll give you an example. We've had 35,000 individual small donations in the last 18 days, which for us is unprecedented. We typically get 30 or 40 individual donations a day, and we're seeing sometimes as many as 1,500 or 2,000. 92% of them, Jim, are new first-time donors, and they're all saying the same thing: is we've got to make sure that that we feed the kids who are being impacted by this. So anybody who's, and in the early days of this crisis, there was a lot of attention to the fact that schools were closing and kids who depended on school meals weren't going to be able to get them as they used to. So some 30,000 people for the first time have said, I've got to act on this fact that kids are hungry. The same kids were, dealing with the same issues before this crisis, but it didn't have people's attention the same way.
That's right.
So I'm hoping there's a broader base of support and a higher level of consciousness that makes this work, less the exception and more the rule. How's the faith community? I know I'm sure it's impossible to generalize, but how's the faith community? Where are they putting their focus? Are you able to crystallize that?
Well, as you know, we've got the phone with these calls. We've got Catholic Charities and lots of people, even the people who do the kind of rescue mission soup kitchens, they're on the line. Certainly for Black churches, Hispanic churches, Asian American churches, white churches, we're all looking at who's vulnerable among us. And that's because that's our job. And yet that's becoming more clear to us. It's revealing what our job always is. And I think that's really becoming a very powerful thing. And we're on the phone last night with the same people, Catholic, Evangelical, Mainline Protestant, Black, Hispanic churches, about what we're saying to Congress. And one of the places they haven't acted enough is in the area of food. SNAP, this supplemental nutrition program, has got to be increased. It's got to be strengthened. And then we do that at our local communities, and it brings people together. I was struck with all the early millennial elder people talk. It was millennials who got their phones together in New York and figured out, as they only can, how to find elderly people who want what they needed food-wise and to deliver the food to them. So food feeding is one of the first things that faith people do. And that whole notion of sharing food and sharing the table. The table is this week is this will come out after that, but Holy Week is this week. And, you know, we had a Last Supper at a table with Jesus sitting with his disciples, and somehow the table and who's at the table and who's not, and who's being taken care of and who's not. These are deeply religious issues for us, and how to find those people in our communities, but then also how to advocate and press government to put the needs of those people, the least of these whom Jesus talked about, the least of these are the least important in Washington. And so our job is to make the least of these the most important.
And what's your confidence level that will change now? You know, we've always had this fault line in our public policy conversations about big government versus small government. Everybody seems to realize that, you know, we need big government to jump in and help in this case. Do you think that will extend to the most vulnerable, to the least of these?
I think it's the only thing that could bring us together. If it's a philosophical argument, big government, small, you know, as you and I both know, that's not the issue. The issue is effective government. It's working with the nonprofit world and the private sector, but government, what's clear is government in a time like this is the only place big enough to respond. So how do we get away from our philosophical differences and focus on the most vulnerable, not just during this time, but after this time? And we've seen during this time how and where people are most vulnerable. There are gaping holes in what's called the safety net. And if we don't fill those holes afterwards, we've learned nothing from this. So it was good on the call the other day. We had an evangelical leader say, we need politicians from both parties and both sides of the aisle to prioritize poor people. And I said, amen. Would you close in prayer for us? And my hope is that this can bring us together. That text for me, that Matthew 25 text, was my conversion text. Jesus says, I was hungry. It was me. It's called the it was me text. Huh. I was hungry and you gave me food, or you didn't. And that's what it comes down to. He's saying, it was me. I was the one who lost those school lunches. That was me. And I couldn't find the parking lot where they had them. That was me. So if you say you love me, pay attention to them.
We're talking about how people are perceiving the role of government in a different way. How are you experiencing people finding faith in a different way in a time of fear like this? Do people come to the faith in a different way than they had before?
You know, we don't know that yet. It's a great question, though. What I'm finding is that people who are churched and people who are unchurched, both are looking for inspiration and sustenance, how to get through this. And so it's not a time for worrying about doctrine or proselytizing. It's a time for finding how to, you know, late at night when our work is done, and for me it was very late last night, you're trying to go to sleep and you're thinking about, you know, your family and those close to you and what you've got to do tomorrow. And I think people are looking for that kind of sustenance. So, you know, again, after this is over, it'll be partly how faith communities responded. Did we respond in a self-serving way to make sure our charities got funded or something? Or did we really make the solidarity? How do we keep the physical distancing again and again from social isolation? That's our role, I think, in that nonprofit world that you and I both live. That's our role. And to force government to be accountable. But we never just depend on the best they can do. So I think how the faith community leads or doesn't lead during a time like this will probably answer your question, what people think about faith afterwards.
What else should our government be doing now? We've been focused probably more narrowly at our end on an issue that you raised, which is SNAP, formerly the food stamp program. We think it's the most systemic and most important way to ensure that families will have the resources and can spend them with dignity and respect to make the best choices for their families. That's only one piece. We've also been doing a lot to kind of knock down some of these barriers that I talked about. It used to be that only a child could access a school meal, and we've changed that so that parents can actually go pick up the meals at the sites. It used to be you could only pick up one meal, and we've changed that so that you can pick up 3 or 5 or 10, so you don't have to go out every day. So lots of regulations and restrictions have been waived, but we've been focused probably more narrowly in that food and hunger space. Are there other things that we should be paying attention to in terms of the advocacy work to get government to make the right decisions going forward?
Well, I'm saying snap, 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 snap at the top.
Okay. We are too. I'm glad to hear you say that.
We are. Because as you know well, feeding people is, people need food. And feeding people is it's not everything, but if we're not feeding people, they're going to die. And SNAP, the other thing about SNAP is it's so effective, and it not only feeds people, but it stimulates the economy. That money is spent right away. When people who need food are, as I say, food insecure, which means hungry, when people get those SNAP benefits, which often run out in the third week of the month, when they get that food money right now, they spend it. So SNAP is maybe the most effective way to serve people's immediate needs and revitalize the economy at the same time. And so we're calling in this, hopefully, this new bill that we'll see hopefully sooner rather than later. When this comes out, I hope we're past it. But, I want to see a 15% increase in SNAP at least. And we're calling for that across our spectrum in the faith community. But SNAP is very concrete. It's effective. It works well. It will not only help the people who are hungry, it'll really help revitalize the economy because the money spent. So, but I remember, our last call, we talked about the schools, and one of my former kids on staff is now he's now the head of the school board in his city. And he called me and said, we're feeding kids. We had to feed kids, but boy, this was not the business we signed up for as teachers and all that. And then we realize they can't come to the schools. So we go out in buses, and so we got food in the bus, and then all these kids come up. And of course, you're supposed to be a student to get the food. That's the rules. But we're not going to ask for student IDs, right? Kids hungry and need food, or moms are coming out. Just like you were saying, moms are coming out. We're not supposed to give food to moms, but we are. And then mom says, I get two more kids at home. And so we give her more food for the kids at home. So it's like all the rules get broken because you've got the immediate need out there. Yeah. So that, those kind of stories, he said, so what do I do? I said, well, first of all, I'm encouraged by your story because you're doing the right thing. When you go out into the, he said, I have never seen vulnerability like this in my community, this is Minnesota. I've never seen how vulnerable people are in my own community. I've seen nothing like this since I worked in refugee camps in the Middle East. This is a kid who has been in Middle East refugee camps, and he's seeing that now in Minnesota. And so, again, food reveals so many things. And like you're saying, what do you do? You're going to give food to the kid who doesn't have a student ID. Yep, you are. And the mom, yep, you are. And the kid, she says she has, which she has at home. So I think this can change us. If we just respond to immediate needs, that's not enough. This has to change us. And when so many people are giving to your work for the first time, that's an indication that this could change us. I hope it does.
Well, Jim, I'll share a really interesting story right along these lines, almost like the mirror image, opposite in a way. Of what you were talking about, but it has to do with a conversation I had last week with a kind of a corporate exec who oversees a kind of a holding company of lots of small businesses. And he was saying to me that the Small Business Administration in his View had gone from being the slowest agency in the country to, you know, one of the fastest. And he said they did it by, you know, getting rid of all their regulations, all their rules. He said, we know there's going to be some fraud. We know there's going to be some abuse. That's okay. We need to act with speed. The greater good is to, you know, get these funds out there. Now, I haven't usually heard business leaders say the same thing about the SNAP program. And, you know, and we all know that over the last 15 years, we have wrung out, you know, 99.9% of any fraud or abuse that ever existed there.
That's right.
But this notion that, you know, that's human nature, that's going to exist in every sector. It's now okay in the business sector, at least according to some of the folks that I've talked to, because, you know, they understand the need to help the majority of folks who are going to benefit. I hope people bring that same empathy and larger worldview to the social sector, because, you know, we deal with programs that aren't perfect, but we know that in 99% of the cases, they have their intended impact. And we tend to get hung up on some sensational stories about 1 or 2% of the cases. But I'm hoping it creates a larger worldview for a lot of folks.
Moving fast. I like that, moving fast, because when we had this meeting on the phone with all these faith leaders, Catholic bishops and Salvation Army and National Association of Evangelicals, National Council of Churches, very diverse politically and theologically, and we decided to act on SNAP in the middle of the Senate debate on the first bill. And like business, churches don't move fast, and church organizations and denominations don't move fast. But we had a statement in the hands of the senators the next day. We never moved that fast in the faith community, but we did. I had senators emailing me back saying, thank you. This brings the moral authority of the churches to this debate about SNAP. So when churches can move fast on SNAP, on feeding people, that's a sign of change.
You know, are there some examples, Jim? I'm just wondering, for folks who are listening, are there either senators or policymakers or elected officials who you feel are particularly responsive to, as you were just describing it, the moral authority of the faith community? Who does it resonate with? Whose leadership would be inspiring to you and to the larger faith community?
Well, there is right now, to be honest, there is more openness or resonance with these concerns of ours in the churches among some of the Democrats, but there's also a list of Republicans who care about these things too. And so we're going to be reaching out again this week, and we'll be speaking to the speaker, Nancy Pelosi. We'll be speaking to Schumer, the leader, their leader in the Senate, but also there's a whole list of Republicans that we're going to be also reaching out to. Because this is one of the issues that has to bring us together. So sometimes up there, I talk to people who are in like the prayer breakfast movement, and they often say, let's leave politics outside the door and let's just pray and talk about our personal faith. And I understand that leaving partisan politics outside the door, but that Matthew 25 text that Jesus instructs us to care for the least of these, you can't leave them outside the door. So they've got to be in the room. And so the more we can get past the partisan and the polarization that has, I was talking to someone who leads a huge organization that serves people in this country yesterday. And he said to me, our polarization has atrophied our compassion and our common good muscle. Our polarization has atrophied our compassion and common good muscle. Brian Gallagher, that was actually, I'll name him because that was a wonderful thing. United Way, he runs.
Yeah.
And what he's wondering is if whether this moment could bring that muscle back, could that common good muscle, I love that phrase that Brian said. So how do we use this moment to do that? And will the complete polarization up on the Hill, will that be changed at all by this? But it takes leadership all up and down. Mayors that I'm talking to and governors, a lot of them are showing tremendous leadership right now. Probably much more than, certainly much more than we see at the White House in particular, I want to say. But local leaders have to serve people. They have to get jobs done, fix problems. And so a lot of the leadership that we need, I think, is really more at that state and local level.
Well, I'm going to play this podcast before I go to bed, because you're leaving me much more hopeful and less fearful about the future. And I really, you're helping me see some real good that could come out of this. So thank you.
Well, you know, when we were worried about the kids, we all saw these kids going to school lunches. A talk with you was one of the first talks I had, and I knew that I was talking to the right place, because that was it. How we respond to this is going to be a sign of where we're going. So I'm very grateful for you and for your work, and you're responding to the practical moment of feeding people, which I think becomes really sort of an archetype, if you will, of how we're going to respond. So we should keep talking. This is good, because when we talked about this feeding thing with kids right at the beginning, we weren't sure what would happen. And I thought, well, got to talk to Billy Shore about this. And so we talked, and I'm glad we're still talking.
I am too. Thanks for your work and for your words, Jim. They give a lot of us inspiration and hope, and help us connect to faith sometimes in ways we didn't even realize that we were capable of. So thank you.
Billy, I'm so glad to speak with you today, and so grateful for you and all the work that goes on. So bless you, my brother. This is Jim Wallace for the Soul of the Nation. God bless you.